Hello.
Hi.
I'm Sasha.
And I'm Ezra.
And welcome to another episode of our podcast.
Concerning climate.
Today, we have Dr. Amalia Leguizamon.
Amalia Leguizamon is an associate professor of sociology. She is also a core faculty member at the Stone Center for Latin American Studies and a member of the Environmental Studies for Faculty Advisory Committee. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
What are GMOs?
GMOs are genetically modified organisms, right? So what it means is that they have a component that is genetically modified. Now, what does this mean is, it's quite simple in a way and quite complex. The key thing, I study particularly genetically modified crops, genetically modified seeds, right? You can modify animals, you can modify different biological organisms. I study seeds in particular. What is a genetically modified seed is a seed that has been transformed in a laboratory in a way in which scientists insert the DNA of a virus, of a bacteria into the new seed. Now, the interesting thing about this is that in a way, modifying seeds and modifying animals is something that we human beings have been doing for 10,000 years, right? But this new wave of genetic modification, particularly with the GMOs that we talk about now, is that they are substantially different because these have been creating labs, right? There is no way that this, when we talk about this particular GMOs or genetically modified seeds, there is no way that these have been able to crossbreed in natural life, right? They require a new technology. And this technology is this genetic modification. Now, the new varieties are called CRISPR, right? But these are things that happen in a laboratory. So these are GMOs. And there are, particularly for crops, there are mostly four: corn, canola, soybeans, and cotton.
How can making GMOs like relate to climate change?
How does making GMO relate to climate change? That's a very complex question. It does and it doesn't, right? So the key thing about genetically modified seeds in particular is that, as I said earlier, the main crops that are genetically modified are these four: soybeans, corn, cotton, canola. Those are 99% of all the GMO seeds that we grow in the world. Now, what is the connection between that and climate change? There are multiple steps. The main thing is that for growing, particularly genetically modified soy and genetically modified corn, is that you grow those crops in a very large farm. Right, so the use of this new technology requires other technologies, particularly large machinery, right, that you use to plant these crops and also to fumigate these crops. Like these crops most significantly require lots of chemical pesticides, right? So when this type of large-scale farming began expanding, right, they take over other farms and the farms get bigger and then you have to fumigate more pesticides, right? So that has an impact on the soil, on the water, right, in terms of pollution, in terms of soil depletion, right? And so that changes ecosystem dynamics, and that also impacts people. So climate change is, as you guys know, a very, very complex ecological change. But it's not just about, I would say, the impact on the environment, right, like on the biological environment, but what is happening to the people who live and work in these spaces, right? So as I said, it is not a one-link connection, right, but we can look into the ways in which industrial agriculture, right, like this way of growing our food, transforms society and the environment. And it's not about, as I said, about the technology itself. It's not just about the GMO, but about the ways in which we do this. And then you can connect that to the way in which, what kinds of food we grow, right? What do we use these soybeans for? How do we ship them? And all that has different multiple scalar effects over people and the planet.
How do GMOs affect the political economy? Also, for those who don't know, what is the political economy?
What is the political economy? That's a difficult question. So when we're talking about the political economy, we're thinking about, okay, I will try not to use big words. When we're talking about the political economy, what we're thinking is about the social arrangements, right? What kind of laws and policies, right, are organized, in particular for what I study, agriculture. Or also, when we're talking about what kinds of economic arrangements and institutions, right, organize this. And who has, the key question is, like, who has control over all these processes, right? Like, who owns the farms? Who hires the workers? Who pays the farmers? Who gets to buy this food? Who, like, how are all the steps that give us food on our plate come together, right? So when we tie all the steps of this chain, right, that bring you whatever you're eating, right? All those complex organizations and decisions that happen at a scale that we don't see it, right? Like, that is the thing about when we talk about the structure of the political economy, it's big. We say that it's macro, right? It's big, it's out there, but there are people that are making decisions. There are people that become like the CEOs of the particular companies that design the seed, that sell the seed, that sell the pesticides, for example. There are people that take a post in the companies that that own farms, right? Or that export seeds, for example. Yes? So that is what we're talking about when we're talking about the political economy. And now I think your question was something like, what's the relationship between GMOs and the political economy? So when we're talking about GMOs and the political economy, what we do is that we try to think into what are these, we say in sociology, these actors, right? Like these people and these companies or sectors, right? In terms of the government, in terms of, as I said, the companies that have power, that have control over agriculture in general. So what we're doing is looking at, okay, what does the government do to either aid GMOs or not, right? So does the government give subsidies? Does the government give money to farmers to plant soybeans or cotton or corn that is genetically modified? Or does the government give money to organic apple growers in New York State? Right? So we want to see what these differences are and how that may change the relationships between people and the relationships between people and the resources that they need to grow food, right? Having land, you need machines, right? You need seeds, you need all those things to be able to grow food. Make sense?
Yeah. So what is the most interesting thing you've learned from your research?
The most interesting thing I learned from my research, well, multiple things. Most significantly is that the situation is very complex. And here I live and teach here in the United States, right? And we tend to think particularly as consumers, GMOs become this thing that sometimes we don't want to eat, or we're concerned about, or we're afraid about, right? Or that we can be even against GMOs, but we don't really know what or how or why or when do we even eat them, or why might they harm us or not? So when I arrived to my fieldwork in Argentina, what I found out is that the situation is much more complex than that. And it's just not being for or against, right? And particularly because in Argentina is the third largest grower of genetically modified crops, right? The United States is the first, right? So they're growing a lot of these genetically modified crops. And I arrived there thinking, oh, why do you do this? This is bad, right? And the thing is that it is not. For people in Argentina, growing these soybeans have given them lots of money, right? And in terms for a country that is suffering constant economic crisis, right? People need money, people need jobs, people need to work, people need to make an income. And growing these soybeans has allowed them to grow more food for less money and bring more money into their household. So that means that their families are doing better and they can send their children to better schools and live a better life in many ways. At the same time, they are also being exposed to this chemical pesticides, right? So there are the fumigations and then people are getting ill and they don't know what to do. So the situation, so what I learned mostly is that the situation is quite complex and it is not the right position to be to show up to people and say, oh, you're doing this thing that is wrong. And it's better to listen and hear and really ask, like, what might be the situation in which you are in that might be quite complex and might be quite difficult to understand. Try to get in the shoes of the other person. Make sense?
Yeah. So you kind of already touched on this, but in what ways can GMOs hurt people or make them ill?
Well, that's the thing is that GMOs don't hurt people or make them ill. The GMOs are just a technology in a way, right? The question is how is this technology used and for what purposes? So this is the interesting thing is that there is the potential of developing a kind of genetically modified crop that may actually help. We don't know, like the technology is out there and it is being used. So the question is, how are we using this technology and who is using this technology for what benefits and what purposes? So the questions become into less about the technology itself, but about who are the people that are putting this technology out there? And this is the political economy, right? Like try to think about this relationship. The key thing about genetically modified soybeans in particular is that in order to grow these crops, you need to do that in a very, very large scale, right? So we're talking about farmers that are really, really big. And that is the only way to make agriculture profitable, right? For these farmers to have a profitable business. So what happens is that as the farms grow, then less people, people that have smaller farms need to sell their farms. So then this one company that owns one farm becomes bigger, right? So inequality increases. That's a thing that harms people, right? Because it means that people that live in the rural towns need to move away into the city, try to find another job, right? The other thing that happens when you're growing these crops at a very, very large scale is that the way in which farmers fumigate the crops, which is something that is necessary because when you're growing one crop, this is what we say, when we talk about monocrops, is that we're growing just one crop. So it's a huge land of soy. What happens is that these farms are more susceptible to disease and to pests, right? So the way in which farmers control those pests is through chemicals, right? So what happens then is that the farmers are using gigantic machines or even planes to fumigate the farms, and it's very hard to control that. So then the rural towns that are near the farm, they're being fumigated with these chemical pesticides, right? And these chemical pesticides might be less harmful than they were in the past, and they are, but the problem is that the fumigation is constant. Right, In Argentina, for the people that I spoke with, some of these families have been fumigated with this for 20 years. Imagine, right? Like, what is the constant effect of being exposed to these toxic agrochemicals? And I mean, we're learning now what is happening to people, like for their own health, for being exposed to this. So, but the key thing is that the problem is not the technology per se, right? Like, it's not that GMOs are bad because, right? The problem is that because of the way in which we're using these genetically modified crops, it has all these unintended consequences down the line.
So what kind of threats does Argentina face because of climate change?
What threats does Argentina face because of climate change? I don't know the answer to that question. I am not an specialist on climate change in agriculture, in Argentina. It's something that I'm going to start looking into my next project. So maybe in the next few years, I'll be able to tell you a better situation. The main thing that is happening in Argentina right now, which is something that is drawing my attention, is that there have been, like here in the United States, in California and in Australia, is that there have been massive fires. That is something that has started happening more often now, and it is happening in the areas where soybeans are grown. And sometimes, same exactly as in Brazil, right? I don't know if you guys have heard about what has been happening, the fires in the Amazon too, right? What is happening is that sometimes farmers, in order to grow their farms even more, they start fires, right, to be able to have more land to grow crops. Sometimes that spirals out of control. And also because the weather is changing, right, as all over the world, also in Argentina. So that is something that has been happening lately that is of high concern.
So you touched on this with you said about the farmers burning areas to get more land, but how does agriculture and farming affect rainforests in South America?
Well, one of the main ways in which it affects forests and rainforests, as I said right before, is in this demand for land, right? Large-scale farmers who need more land to grow crops, this type of extensive mechanized crops like soybeans in particular, cotton, and also cattle ranchers, right? This is something that is happening a lot in Argentina, in Brazil, in Central America, right? We need more land to have more cows, right? Because we're eating more and more meat. And this is also in relationship to the soybeans, right? Most of the soybeans that we grow are used to feed cattle. So there's a lot of pressure put into expanding what we say, expanding the frontier of agriculture, right? So that we can have more land to grow more soybeans and to put more cattle. And the main way in which that is done is through either replacing other crops, right? So we are not growing what we were growing before, but we're going to grow this new thing, or mostly by burning land, right? Burning forest and also displacing indigenous populations, most times quite violently. Most times quite violently, right? So that is the main way in which we're putting pressure onto forest and rainforest. The other main thing that is happening is that farmers, producers, growers, and the exporters need to be able to bring their product from the farm into the port, right? Because the crops are always shipped somewhere. This is the main problem about industrial agriculture, is that we're not eating local, right? We're not eating the things that we're growing nearby, but the soybeans that Argentina grows, the soybeans that the United States grow, need to be shipped to China, need to be shipped to Europe, right? So in order for the farmer to bring that pile of soybeans, right? Those tons of soybeans that they've grown, how do you bring them to the port? Well, you need a truck, and for that you need a road, right? So in order to build those roads, you need to also burn down the forest. So that's another important pressure that is happening now. Like all around in South America, the main hub, the main center for this is around Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay and Uruguay. If you see that area of the river basin, where all those soybeans are grown into South America and need to be transported so then they can be shipped to China. All that means that there are massive infrastructure development now, right? Massive roads or ports that need to be built in order to ship those crops. And in order to do that, you need to get rid of people, right? You need to, like, whoever is living there needs to get out. And if there was a forest that needs to be burned down. So those are two key pressures that we're putting on local ecosystems and local communities in order to grow food the way we're growing food.
So if you had one piece of advice and or information that you could give to us and everyone listening, what would it be?
One piece of advice. I think I would say, try to think in complex ways. Because what happens is that we tend, and this makes sense because climate change is so big and we don't know where to begin. So we're really desperate into trying to find, okay, what are 10 top things I can do to save the planet, right? Like we want to be able to know, right? Because that brings us some control and also it makes us feel like we're doing something. But at the same time, as you guys know, probably after doing all this research, is that the situation is very, very complex and it's very, very difficult. And there is no place where you can start and fix it all. But at the same time, there is a place where you can start, as you guys are doing now, right? There's something that you can do. So figure out what you're good at and try to think about how things connect. It's key. So if one good piece of advice, I would say, try to keep it simple, while at the same time, remembering that it is very complex and try to be okay with that.
So that concludes our interview. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
We really hope you enjoyed this episode. And remember to do good things for the environment. You also can follow us on our Instagram @ Concerning Climate Podcast. See you soon.